Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch, Wednesday afternoon, January 25th, here on 720 WGN. It's pretty gray out there. I think Kim probably said some precipitation coming in, but it is sunny skies of your portfolio. You open up that little folder, and boy, there's just rays of sunshine coming out. The Dow Jones Industrial Average crossed the 20,000 point today, and there's no turning back. A chicken in every pot, and here's Terry Savage to guarantee.
I wish I could guarantee that, but I can guarantee that a lot of people are going to have a happier retirement because of the market reaching new highs.
Pretty amazing, and, right, that it went from 19,000 to 20,000 in 42 days, I think it was, the shortest time period ever. And it almost exactly, or maybe it does exactly, almost exactly coincides with the election of Donald Trump.
Well, come on now. We know that. As
I'm just saying.
That's a much smaller, that's a much smaller gain. It actually took... To double from 10,000 to 20,000 is actually pretty a long time compared to the time it took the Dow to double in value in the 1980s and 1990s. That's okay. Let's take it any way we can get it. There is good reason for the stock market to be happy, and it confounds so many of my friends. So I want to give a disclaimer here before we start talking about the economy and the market.
Okay.
Okay. I have been trying desperately to have this conversation with a number of my good friends. I think I have pretty good credentials for being a feminist and a first woman and all of that stuff. And every time I try to start a conversation with, well, maybe Donald Trump won't be so bad.
Oh, no one wants to hear that.
You can see their eyes shut down. I can't do that when I want to go dot, dot, dot for the economy, for the markets, and for your retirement prospects, and possibly for jobs, et cetera. Now, that's not an endorsement of Donald Trump. That's an endorsement of some and not all of the policies that seem to be getting underway here that could turn our slow growth 2% economy into, if he doesn't make some of the wrong moves and makes a lot of the right moves, it could turn into a much faster 3 to 4% growth economy, which could create jobs, and which is what the Dow Jones Industrial Average is telling you it expects will happen.
Okay, so when this happens,
it doesn't mean I endorse everything. It just means that there's some things that are happening.
It means
it could be very, very positive.
It means that you seem to be capable of doing what no other American is capable of doing, saying that there might be a little of good and bad in something, right?
Exactly.
We don't anymore.
Exactly. So in order to have this discussion, which you ought to have, not because you want to argue with me about issues that are social issues, issues that are ego issues, issues on which I may very well take the same side. But because you want to have this discussion because you want to deal realistically with how to handle and manage your investments now, because on a personal basis, that really matters. So number one, you have to recognize that earnings, this is not something new under the new administration, earnings are coming through in a very positive way. The estimates for the S&P 500 for 2017 are about 20% higher than it looks like they came in for all of 2016. And that puts the 2017 looking forward P.E. ratio around 17 times. And that says, well, the market's not overvalued at this point. Second of all, we know there's plenty of money around. It's been sloshing around. A lot of it's been sitting on the sidelines, and that money is either going into A, now the stock market, or B, it's corporations are being nudged and incented to grow here, nudged by things, promises like if you bring things in from overseas, we're going to tax them, and incented by the possibility of lower tax rates. So the first things, some of the first things that the new administration or the President Trump, it's always hard for me to say that right now, have done are positive for the stock market and for business prospects. The pipeline, that's jobs. I don't want to argue with you about the environment because even the Obama administration said it wouldn't hurt the environment. So that's possible. NAFTA, the jury's out on that. I mean, our biggest trading partners, Canada and Mexico, provide us a lot of stuff that doesn't seem to be considered, but maybe that won't be such a bad thing. Regulations, the first thing the president did was say we're going to cut through a lot of this regulatory mess that strangled growth. So it just on an economic side, that's positive. And freezing government hiring, Yeah, not if your brother wanted to get a job in the Labor Department. But the fact is that the government has been growing, and maybe the money that doesn't get spent on government will get spent by business. So I don't want to argue with you on all of this. I mean, there's some really stupid things out there, like the Mexican wall. I mean, what's good that going to do? But the point is, the market is looking at the possibility that there could be great economic growth. And what we have on our side is technology.
Okay. I'm not going to argue with you. I want to look at it from a slightly different angle then. Because you and all the experts always say that. No, you do. And we've had this conversation before. Actually,
I don't consider myself an expert. I consider myself a person who looks logically at what's out there.
Let me tell you something.
I care what matters to your money and mine.
Let me tell you something, Terry Savage. In this room, you're an expert. Okay.
Okay.
But Bill Leff brought this up earlier, and I've talked to you about it. It's like the markets love certainty. They react well to certainty. And it seems to me, Bill brought this up, and I tend to agree, we're in a pretty uncertain time. And I always argue that I don't think there's ever certainty. So how does that whole certainty thing figure into this?
The markets react better to opportunity than they do to certainty. And the certainty that the markets had of the last 8 years, and the markets, when I say the markets, reflecting the business climate, has been that there would be more regulation, no tax breaks. Now the opportunity comes with, okay, maybe we're going to have an opportunity to grow. Maybe we'll pay less taxes. I think the market is looking forward to the opportunity and is willing to take the uncertainty as long as the opportunity looks in general, so positive, which doesn't mean I couldn't give you a dozen things that this administration has already said or few of them that it's already done that strike me as absolutely counterproductive. That was a good word because I was thinking of some other more proactive word.
Okay, wait.
But the market is looking forward to the opportunity for business to grow.
Mike Pence just called and he wants to put the Trump-Pence bumper sticker on your car. Is that okay with you?
No, because I am apolitical.
I know. I'm giving you a hard time.
Political parties to get us in this mess, but it's the mindset.
I agree with you, and we are on the same page.
Out on the plank, on the mindset. The mindset is that America is a very special place. We've proved it time and time again. We grow out of our problems. I must say that how wrong he could be on these trade deals that could really mess up the whole thing. The fact is that while a lot of our jobs went overseas, a lot of our jobs were lost to technology.
Right.
But we are the leaders in technology. So, yeah, there may not be truck drivers. That may be the next thing to go like there weren't as many farmers and so forth after everything got mechanized. But there will be people with different skills. Our Achilles heel is our educational system to provide the people here in America to do the next new best jobs.
That's Terry Savage. Terry, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I want to ask you quickly about people who aren't in the market. Maybe is it too late for them now with it at this height? But then we're going to play with our smartphones as well in the second segment. It's 12:22. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Terry Savage is on a phone line. You can read more of what Terry has to say at terrysavage.com. And she's got a column up there actually about fintech that I want to get to. But let's just start, Terry. The big news today that the Dow is above 20,000. And, people are already talking about, well, this means that the end is near. I mean, is it too late for people to get into this market?
No. That's called climbing a wall of worry. And that's what, because I've been so around so long. I remember not the first time the Dow went above 1,000, but one of the few first times the Dow went above 1,000. I said the same thing back then in my late 60s. Look, the Dow is now at 20,068. The S&P, which nobody ever knows what level it's at. I mean, nobody, it's not a retail kind of a statistic, but it's hovering just under 2,300, 2,296. So that's another benchmark that'll be broken.
Is the S&P a better reflection of the situation we're in than the Dow?
No, I wouldn't say that. It's just that the Dow is a more popular number. The S&P, of course, is a broader index. It's weighted differently. We don't have to get into that. I think there's general agreement that there's a lot of optimism in the stock market. But I don't think, as I said, that's unwarranted. What'll be interesting, it'll take 9 months or maybe a year for tax policy to change and so forth. And it could take very short time for us to mess up global trade. So we have to see what happens. Nothing is guaranteed, but It's never too late. Look, I have consistently said this forever and ever, including when the Dow was at, what, 6,700 in March of 2009. If you are young, or I know who you are out there, remember, you all send me emails and post stuff on my blog, so I get a pretty good feel for who's out there listening and caring about this. And some of you have children and grandchildren. If you could just give them the lesson that if they're putting that $300 a month away in the 401k, it doesn't matter if it's too high because they have the long-term time horizon. And yes, there are ups and downs in the market, but over the long run, it's been a terrific investment, especially dividends reinvested and growing tax deferred. So you know that.
Okay.
Now, if you've got a short-term horizon, then yeah, the market is risky, but no riskier today over 20,000 than it was, 2 weeks ago under 19,000.
Okay, we've just got a couple of minutes left, and I want to get to this. It's a column that you can read at terrysavage.com. If you are over 60, chances are, in fact, 80% odds that you do not do any investing or banking on your mobile device. And you say, and I don't. We do it online.
Half of Americans over 65 own a smartphone or a tablet.
But you're saying that people should not only have a smartphone, but learn to use it for banking.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is a very interesting front page article in the Wall Street Journal about how many people still stand in line at the grocery store and write a paper check.
Really?
I emphasize security. I emphasize secure connections, a protected Wi-Fi connection. But what I was really trying to do was say, seniors, and I guess I've just seen a lot of them or talked to a lot of them lately, I'm going to fully disclose something. You'll never hear this again. But I still carry my old flip phone. When I go horseback riding or when I'm doing sports, I like to tuck it in my pocket. My 6S is too big to do that with. And people laugh, and I always call it my burner phone. But I guess I was with my 95-year-old father.
Terry Savage, Private Eye.
Well, I was with my 95-year-old father, and, he opens his flip phone, and he can make a few calls. And I realized I want to tell people that my 95 is maybe a little too old for my dad, but I want to tell you to get a smartphone. First of all, you cannot stay in touch with your grandchildren. They no longer call you on Sundays. You have to learn how to text. You cannot text on a flip phone. Second of all, you need to have them. And the way to do this smartphone thing, by the way, is they all have family plans. I'm not telling you to give up your old flip phone. Just tell them to put you on their family plan and get you a smartphone. And then the column goes into a list of things you can do to stay connected with your money. But the most important thing is that you stay connected with the world. And there seems to be a great divide. When I read that statistic, half of Americans over 65 own a smartphone. That's sad.
You got
to stay in touch with your kids. You got to get on Facebook. They'll show you how to do it. You will be the coolest grandparent in the world.
All right, Terry, we got to go. But when you're done now this afternoon, I want you to text me a picture of you with your flip phone because I really want to see it badly.
I'm not going to put that on the air, but I would. It really, but it's a good emergency phone for me, so I keep it on my plan.
Nice to talk to you. Have a good week. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much for tuning in. And Frank Sennett comes by from time to time on Wednesdays from Crane Chicago Business to talk about some of the stories in the magazine. He's on the phone line now. Frank, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve.
Hey, have you seen The Founder yet?
I have not. I'm actually really looking forward to it. Michael Keaton's career resurgence continues.
Yeah, that's true. And I have not seen it. I saw him on Jimmy Kimmel maybe last week talking about Kroc and how he wasn't an altogether likable guy. This is a movie about Ray Kroc, the guy who sort of bought the name from the McDonald's brothers in California, came to Chicago, and the rest is history. But there's a great story in Crane's where they go back to some of the lawyers who were with Kroc from the beginning, and they sort of gave a little critique of the film.
Yeah, so I love this story because it's a fact check of this biographical film. And these three folks, Donald Lubin, his 83, Chicago lawyer who reviewed the loan documents for the company nearly 60 years ago, became Ray Kroc's personal attorney. Shelby Yastro, a former legal colleague and later McDonald's general counsel. And Al Golan, 87, a PR executive who cold called Kroc in 1957 to get the business. So PR and two lawyers, all in their 80s, and they have a couple of bones to pick with the film. The first major contention that they say as a compared to the script, they say that Kroc did not offer a 1% royalty on McDonald's sales to the McDonald brothers out in California, in addition to buying them out. There was a purported handshake deal that's contained in the script, and all three of them say flat out never happened.
Because Kroc would have never walked away from a contract, they say.
They say if he had made that handshake deal, that he wouldn't have walked away from it. And also it didn't make sense because the reason he was trying to buy them out in the first place was in part to get out from under the royalty provision that he had instituted with the McDonald brothers early on. So he asked them, essentially, what's your price? They came back and said $1 million in cash, and they did ask for something extra. These guys said each got a Cadillac as well, a brand new Cadillac. So can you imagine? Billions and billions of hamburgers sold, right. And these guys got to keep, you know, they wanted to keep their franchise incubator out there in the San Bernardino area, and $1 million.
And they were happier than pigs in mud, is the quote from one of the guys. But they also wanted Hawks tickets.
I'm sure the McDonald's brothers' heirs might have a bone to pick with this fact check as well. So.
They also wanted Hawks tickets, which I kind of like.
Yeah, so the Blackhawks were in the Stanley Cup that year, and they asked for tickets, and they got hooked up with Blackhawks versus Toronto Maple Leafs tickets in the 1962 Stanley Cup Finals.
Yeah, check it out. It's a pretty cool story, and I do want to see the movie because, and I didn't realize, well, I mean, I guess I would have had I thought of it, but it's almost a local film, and so much of it must have happened here in Chicago.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. After Birdman last year, I just think, you know, he's doing some great acting.
It's kind of nice to see because he was so popular and then kind of fell out of favor.
Yeah.
And now he's making real movies. So, Michael
Keaton.
And he's
a journalism hero, too, now.
Oh, yeah.
The Boston movie, yeah.
So he's had a string of three in a row, really, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Maybe he could play Mike Madigan in his next film.
That would be a dark side.
The Governor Rauner, just when the show started, was giving his State of the State address, and we opted not to bring it to you live today, frankly, because, well, I just think there would be, I don't know how much value there is in it. He was on with Steve Cochran earlier talking about the great optimism he has, but he's continued to talk about that, and they still can't get any kind of a deal done. It looked like there was some movement in Springfield earlier this week. I don't know where that Senate thing's going. Do you?
No, it sounds like they have tougher sledding ahead than they thought they might have. The Senate leaders on both sides of the aisle, Democratic and Republican, got together, crafted what both sides say is a pretty complex deal, a lot of moving parts. And so they had hoped to move it out of committee onto the floor for a vote really quickly because a lot of people were opposing it. So they wanted to get out in front of the opposition, and they weren't able to do that. So now they're doing informational sessions in the committees on various aspects of the budget plan. They're hoping to push it out of the committee, but it is not a slam dunk.
Greg Hines, the great political writer at Cranes, has a piece on the tax plan and the different way taxes would go up. There was a soda tax proposal, which was very unpopular. That's gone, but it looks like a lot of other things are going up.
Yeah, so they are talking about a business opportunity tax.
I love that. Wait a minute. Let's back that one up.
A
business opportunity tax. So what they're saying is we're going to charge you for the chance you have to do business in Illinois.
Is that like the guy who walks into the candy shop and he's like, I'd like you to be able to stay open. You pay me $100 a week.
Right. Exactly.
Business opportunity tax.
So their point is, though, that there are a lot of businesses that don't make any money, and when they don't make any money, they don't pay any taxes. So let's institute a business opportunity tax that everyone has to pay whether or not they make money, right? That's kind of what that's about.
Yeah, exactly. Whether or not they turn a profit. The protection racket joke notwithstanding, that is the you've driven right to the essence of it. And then they also want to put a service tax, which would be, it's been long talked about, an extension of the sales tax that would be imposed on services. You know, goods are taxed with the sales tax. Now they're talking about repair and maintenance of personal property, use of amusement services, including gyms. I don't see a gym as an amusement service, personally, but...
you got to go at the right time.
Right, yeah. Or I'm sure if people see me at the gym, it's an amusement opportunity. So that would be You know, one of the new taxes, telecom excise tax, would be extended to cable and satellite TV. Again, that's something that's been knocked around for quite a while,
The service tax idea is, well, I mean, no one wants to pay more, and I would imagine no service business wants to start dealing with all that. But, I mean, there is some logic to it, right? Why would you pay a sales tax to buy a shirt at a store but not to have, not to go to a health club, not to pay, or maybe a better example.
Or not to have the tailor alter the shirt.
There you go. Exactly. That's a better example. So I can see where that could be fairly extended in some spots.
I agree from a logical perspective, but we also have to say, I think out of the sake of fairness, that all of these kinds of sales taxes are, in essence, regressive taxes. Lower-income folks end up spending a higher percentage of their income on use taxes than on income taxes and investment taxes. So this would be extending, you know, a fairly regressive tax regime to do that.
Well, to be fair, then they're going to increase the income tax as well, right?
Yeah, so a little something for everybody. Everybody gets a little smoking in this budget.
I want to talk about the clinical trial story as well and Lyft. So Lyft is a ride-sharing company. They're being, I think, probably pounded by Uber, dominated by Uber. They're trying to find inroads, and they've sort of started focusing on medical trials, clinical trials. Explain that for me.
Yeah, it's kind of a cool niche. Continuum Clinical, which is a company based in Northbrook, they recruit patients across the country for drug companies' clinical trials. So when they're trying to test the drug to see if it's safe to come to market, they'll, you know, get 100 people, come to the hospital, take the drug in a double-blind test. They have contracted with Lyft, the ride-hailing service, to take these folks in to the medical centers and back home. And it is an expanding business for Lyft.
It's kind of like, you know, think of it this way. It's like the political parties. They want to get their voters to the polls, right?
Exactly.
So, because these clinical trials only work if the subjects are there to be tested. So one of the incentives would be a free ride. Also, a lot of them are infirmed or suffering through some sort of disability. It's why they're being tested. And this is a way to make sure that the people being tested get to where they are being tested. Well, how is that for an awkward wrap-up?
There you go. And the nice thing about this is it gives you a window into how Lyft can make deals with people who need national transportation solutions, because there's no national taxi company. So this kind of gives you an idea of how these businesses could expand. Anybody that needs, you know, doesn't want to get taxi reimbursements from each patient all around the country, just make a one-stop deal with Lyft. So you can see how, even beyond the clinical trial niche, this could be a nice expanding business.
Pretty cool idea. Yeah, and they got to figure out a way to make it work, because they're struggling when it comes to fighting against Uber. Frank Sennett, thanks very much for joining us.
Doesn't win at all.
Say that again?
The big pink mustache doesn't win at all.
It's a start. It's a really good start, but it doesn't quite get you over the hump. See you later. So how much do you know about the federal judicial system? How much do your kids know? Are they confused by what they the information they have? Are they have a misunderstanding of some of it? Well, the Federal Bar Association is trying to change that. Michael Newman is a U.S. magistrate in the Southern District of Ohio, and he joins us on a phone line now. Judge, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks so much. It's my honor to be on the program. I'm thrilled to be with you.
Well, I want to say thank you as well, because I know we had to reschedule you once we've had a few breaking news events over the past few days. So thanks for that. You're busier than I am, so I'm glad that you were able to reschedule.
Hardly. No issues whatsoever. My pleasure.
Okay, so I want to talk about getting into the schools and teaching kids and all of that. But I want to start with your job. I have a good friend, one of my best friends, has a dad who's a federal judge in Philadelphia. And I was talking to him about talking to you, and he said, "What does a magistrate do?" And I'm thinking, wait a minute, this guy's dad is a federal judge and he has a misunderstanding. I would imagine that's one of the things that you explain when you go out to classrooms.
Precisely right. Very few people, even in the legal community, know what a magistrate judge is. So I'll be happy to tell you. We are federal judges. We sit in federal courts throughout the United States at the trial level, at what's called the district court level. We're appointed for 8-year terms by the judges themselves. Those are 8-year renewable terms. Most magistrate judges that I know sit for 20 years or more. And we do all sorts of things around the country. So when you hear of someone who comes in a federal court and they have a bond, Typically, it's a magistrate judge that does that. Appointing counsel in criminal cases, it's a magistrate judge typically that would do that. Something that very few people seem to know about is Social Security disability cases, where you claim you're disabled and unable to work. Most of those cases are heard by magistrate judges. Pro se cases where plaintiffs don't have lawyers, magistrate judges do those. And then we also hear all the wide variety of civil cases that that are brought in the federal court system, sometimes where the parties consent. So they'll ask the magistrate judge to essentially become the district judge, and then you have all the powers that a U.S. district judge has, including a trial and everything else. So it's a very, very busy docket. How magistrate judges work around the country is different district to district, so that's why there's some confusion. I'll also say what I do a lot of is mediation. That's a big trend in the federal courts, the federal trial courts around the country. So many magistrate judges are called upon to mediate cases. Little known secret that I think many, many civil cases in this day and age get resolved by mediation, and I think sometimes more than trials.
Wow. So, I've been in radio for 30 years, Judge, and when people say to me in radio, they say, well, do you want to work in television? That's what everyone always says. Do magistrates get that? Well, do you want to sit on the bench? Do you want to be appointed by the president?
Yes, to be honest with you, many do. I would like that, sure, obviously, if that happens. Some, I think, don't. I've had some friends, quite frankly, magistrate judges, who become what's called an Article III judge, a U.S. district judge, and some of them will confide in you and tell you that it was more fun when you were a magistrate judge because you were more in the trenches. So I think there's feelings both ways. Personally, I think it'd be a great honor, obviously, to be selected by the president to be a district judge.
Yeah. So tell me about this education program and the idea. And these are lawyers who argue in federal court, as well as judges going into classrooms and sort of, the word indoctrinating keeps coming into my head, which is an incorrect one, but sort of doing ground level education about just what the federal judiciary system is like.
Sure. So I'm the national president this year of the Federal Bar Association. We have about 19,000 members around the country and about 1,500 federal judges. So if you're active in federal court, it's the primary bar association for those that practice or serve as judges in the federal court system. And I had a meeting about 2 years ago with Jim Duff, who's the director of the U.S. courts in D.C., and he and I were just chatting about the fact that many, many young people don't seem to really understand how the federal courts work, what's the difference between the state court system and the federal court system, all those sorts of basic, what I call civics 101 ideas. And we decided to create a system and encourage lawyers and judges to interact with students. And what we're doing this year, and we're going to affect thousands of kids, literally thousands of kids. Either judges will go into classrooms around the country, whether it's elementary school or it's middle school or it's high school. And likewise, we're inviting young people to come into federal courthouses to see what the proceedings are, to meet with the judges, to meet with the lawyers that work in federal courts. And it's really, really proven very successful.
But Judge, what end, really? Because, chances are pretty overwhelming that I will never end up in federal court, or most of those kids you talk to will never end up in a federal courtroom. So why is it important that they understand?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. One, I think just every citizen should know how the court system works. I mean, to be blunt, the system is paid for by tax dollars. But also, I think more importantly, we have the greatest justice system in the world. And I think every citizen should be proud of that and should know how the federal courts work. I also think that there's different components. We're all called upon at some time in our life to do a jury service. And I think, among other practical things, if young people knew that that's how the system works, by serving on a trial jury, a petit jury, or serving on a grand jury when you're called to do so, how important that service is, I think people might have more respect for the courts. And I also think it's important for people across the country to know how hard people in the court system work.
That's
a good
point.
I used to be a partner at a big firm. I used to work crazy hours. I still work long hours as a judge. And I think when young people come into the courthouse and they see how hard judges work and how difficult it is to get cases right the first time, I think they're going to have a greater respect for the system.
Okay, then look at it from the other side. What is it that the judges and the federal lawyers gain by being in these classrooms?
Well, I think it's a sense of educating the next generation, quite frankly. I think it's a sense of having some sense of responsibility that you're passing the torch to the next generation and trying to inspire them. And something inspired all of us to want to be lawyers and judges. And I think it's passing that along. and trying to get the next generation interested in justice and law, in the hope that people will go to law school, will have respect for the law and the rule of law, and some of them, I hope, will become judges.
How do people get more information about this?
FedBar.org is the Federal Bar Association's website. We also have a civics page, FedBar.org/civics, where all of the materials are there, and it's a website that anyone can access, and we'd be delighted for people to look at it, whether you're in the legal system or not. And I think we're making great strides across the country with this effort.
FedBar.org. The Honorable Michael Newman, Magistrate Judge in the Southern District of Ohio. Listen, Judge, I've got one student at the University of Dayton and one at Miami of Ohio. So I know they're both in your district. Do you have any get out of federal prison cards free or anything like that for me?
Well, tell these are your kids?
Yeah.
Well, tell them to give me a call. I do outreach all the time. I'm happy to meet them. I'm serious. I'd be happy to meet them for a cup of coffee. Be happy to have them come over to the courthouse and say hi. I teach at the University of Dayton as an adjunct at their law school. I'd be happy to meet your kids. Tell them to give me a call. You can find me on the internet in about 2 seconds.
Outstanding. Nice to talk to you, Judge. Good luck with this.
Thank you so much.